Tonight on Arena, we look at the enduring appeal of Hitchcock's Vertigo, and Marty and Wendy Bird are still up to no good in the Ozark. Welcome to Friday night's Arena on this hopeful night for Ireland, and we hope for the arts community. Now, the films of Alfred Hitchcock have endured and found new audiences as the decades roll on since his death in 1980. Among all the Hitchcock classics, the likes of Psycho, Notorious and North by Northwest, perhaps the most intriguing and defining work of his career is the 1958 psychological thriller Vertigo. It's the story of Scotty, a retired detective played by James Stewart, who suffers from agoraphobia, an extreme fear of heights. Scotty is engaged by an acquaintance to investigate his wife Madeline, who has been behaving strangely. Well, now, 64 years on from that movie, a new book has just been published exploring the film Vertigo and its legacy. The book is called Haunted by Vertigo. It's edited by Sidney Gottlieb and Donald Martin. And it was in part inspired by a conference held in Dublin in 2017, which asked the question, Hitchcock's Vertigo, the greatest film ever made? I'm joined now by one of the editors of Haunted by Vertigo, that's Sidney Gottlieb, and one of the contributors, Charles Barr. But let's set the scene first. Scotty, played by James Stewart, has had to leave his job as a detective because of his agoraphobia. And here he goes to meet an old acquaintance, Gavin Elster, who wants Scotty to help him.
Well, I wondered whether you'd go back on the job as a special favour to me. I want you to follow my wife. No, it's not that. We're very happily married.
Well, then...
I'm afraid some harm may come to her.
From whom?
Someone dead. Scotty, do you believe that someone out of the past, someone dead, can enter and take possession of a living being?
No.
If I told you that I believe this has happened to my wife,
James Stewart to Scotty being propositioned by Gavin Elster, played by Tom Ellsmore, which gets the psychological ball rolling in Alfred Hitchcock's 1958 drama Vertigo. And as I say, I'm joined by Sidney Gottlieb and Charles Barr, co-editor and contributor to Haunt by Vertigo, a new book on the film. Sidney, you've gathered this impressive bunch of film experts together to share their thoughts on Hitchcock's Vertigo, as we say, 64 years on. Why a new book on the film? What more is there to say about Vertigo?
I think there's always more things to be said about a great film. Part of what makes a film great is that it's, I guess it's really inexhaustible. And one of the interesting things about this collection of essays, which, as you mentioned, was based on papers presented at a conference in Ireland, so Ireland gets a lot of credit here. One of the interesting things about the volume is the people bring to Vertigo a whole bunch of different backgrounds. We might ordinarily not think that Hitchcock's films are rooted in classical mythology. We might not, again, these are new vantage points that when we adopt them, we find out new things about the film.
Now, Sidney, you argue in Haunted by Vertigo that we live in a vertigo world, as the film encompasses some defining elements, you say, of modern life. You talk about romantic exhilaration and anxiety. Could you explain how and take us through James Stewart to Scotty's obsession with Madeline and compare it to some of modern life's dilemmas?
Well, it was really interesting for me to listen to the way you described Vertigo. It sounded fascinating to me, but at first glance, it sounded like a film about a kind of weird, strange, aberrant person. And I think there is a lot of strangeness in Vertigo and in Hitchcock's films in general. But it seems to me that maybe beneath the strangeness or alongside the strangeness is a sense of familiarity, that his crises, his issues, the things on his mind are very much on our mind. I think they have to do with the possibility of love in the world. I think they have to do with reckoning with our mortality, understanding a world that seems very inexplicable at times, and also sometimes seems to assault us. So all those things, I think, are part of the strangeness of Vertigo, but part of the familiarity of it, part of what we recognize, I think, in our own life.
Yes, because as you call the book, it's called Haunted by Vertigo. And Vertigo is really, even though you mightn't describe it like this, we describe it as a psychological thriller, but it is a ghost story. I mean, Madeline is obsessed, we believe, by a dead woman. And then, as it's no spoiler to say that Madeline dies midway through the movie, and then Scotty becomes obsessed by a dead woman. So we are really in a ghost story.
I think that's absolutely true. The only thing I would add to that is I think we need to expand our definition of what a ghost is and what kind of ghosts haunt us. When you hear the term ghost, we usually think first of a kind of supernatural being or a visitor from the past. And that's absolutely a function of a feature of Vertigo. But I think Vertigo shows us characters haunted by other things, haunted by memories, haunted by anxieties and worries. So absolutely, Vertigo is a great ghost story. And it's about the many kind of ghosts that haunt us.
Charles, you are one of the contributors, and you talk, as we say, it's called Haunted by Vertigo. But you're talking about the fact that Vertigo has influenced so many writers and filmmakers, but also that Hitchcock himself was very much influenced by writers and filmmakers, his contemporaries.
Yes, and I'd add to what Sid so well expresses, that it's a film about the cinema. Hitchcock's influenced by past filmmakers and looking ahead to later filmmakers, but the character, Madeline, is a ghost, but she's also a creation of the cinema. She's a sort of fantasy figure for the film viewer. And the film is made in 1958. Important to have that date, that it's the end, basically, of the classical system of cinema. It's a time when, in America particularly, but also in Britain and later other countries such as Ireland, when the bottom is falling out of the cinema as the mass medium and television is starting to take over. So it's almost the last great classical fantasy film. And the Kim Novak character is this extraordinary construction of Hitchcock and the filmmakers. And James Stewart is entranced by her, and the film offers the ultimate pleasures of classical cinema. That is, a beautiful hypnotic story, a beautiful woman, beautiful surroundings, San Francisco, extremely romantic past and present San Francisco. And you get the ultimate fantasy experience, which the character has and which the audience has, and then it's completely cut away from you. The bottom falls out of it, and you're revealed to be watching a construction, which is the construction by the Elster character, whom you evoked at the beginning of your introduction. And it reveals that the whole classical system of cinema is built on a beautiful construction, and it's a fantasy. And that is the kind of almost drawing a line under the 30 years or so of the classical cinema medium. And I think it's the self-reflexivity of Vertigo that helps to make it such a landmark film.
Let's have another clip from Vertigo. This is when Scotty and Madeline, played by Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak, Scotty has saved Madeline after she jumped into San Francisco Bay. And the following day, she calls to thank him. And just as she's leaving in her car, he asks her where she's going.
Where are you going?
Oh, I don't know.
Shopping?
No.
Well, anywhere in particular?
No, I just thought that I'd wander.
Oh, that's what I was going to do.
Oh, yes, that's right. I forgot. It's your occupation, isn't it?
Yeah, well, don't you think it's kind of a waste for the two of us
to wander separately?
Uh-huh.
But only one is a wanderer. The two together are always going somewhere.
No, I don't think that's necessarily true.
You left your door open.
Be right back.
James Stewart there as Scotty and Kim Novak as Madeline. Would you think that Scotty is in love with Madeline Sidney, or do you think that's too simplistic a reading of what's going on? Is it more manipulative? Is it more obsessive?
The short answer, I guess, is all of the above. When we talk about love and the kind of relationships that are, you know, that are love relationships, they're combinations of all those elements. And that might not be a pretty thing to contemplate, but the notion of love as a pure idealistic attraction, I don't think that holds up. I think one of the things that Vertigo shows so well is that love. And many of us still feel that our lives are and should be centered around love. Well, love is not only a difficult proposition, but it's composed of elements that are dangerous, that are worrisome, that are problematic, that are painful, as well as uplifting. So yeah, love, again, in that expanded sense of the term. If you don't mind, I just want to comment very quickly on the clip that you played, which I
Please
think
do.
Is so wonderful. And I don't know if Hitchcock had this in mind at all, but when you listen to the way Jimmy Stewart pronounces that term, wander, it's a combination of wander and wonder. And I think you hear a little bit of that even when Kim Novak says that. And it seems to me that kind of pun is, it's part of Hitchcock's wit and creativity, but it also tells us something very, very interesting about the film. It's a film about wandering, and it's a film about wondering, very much in the way that Charles Barr suggested a moment ago, that it is one of the great classical films about fantasy. And then back to your follow-up question, certainly love involves a lot of wondering and wandering.
And Charles, it based on the readings that Hitchcock did, the writers he was interested, the filmmakers he was interested in, is it those elements of obsession, love, maybe thwarted love, that he was interested in? Was it those central male-female relationships he was interested in?
I think Hitchcock was always interested in male-female relationships, absolutely. He had this story about somebody was went to sleep every night and had a wonderful dream and forgot to remember it. He didn't remember it. So one day he put a pencil and paper down beside his bed, and he had this wonderful dream again. And this time he wrote it down. And then he woke up in the morning. What was the dream? Oh, I've forgotten it. He looked at the paper and it said, "Boy meets girl." There's something very simple and eternal about Hitchcock's cinema, based on that basic reality without which none of us would be here, the fact that boy meets girl and romance develops. And in Vertigo, you look for a happy ending. The great Hollywood classical system leads you towards a happy ending, and Vertigo gives you the most unhappy ending practically in the history of the cinema. That's part of what it is undercutting and showing you, that the wonderful architecture of classical Hollywood cinema, based on beautiful colour photography, beautiful women, hypnotic story, is actually a fabrication. And then he takes away the illusion and shows you the reality of the woman who repeatedly falls to her death, and she wasn't really there at all, and it was all a fantasy that James Stewart is trying to clutch.
Well, if it doesn't get people running back to watching Vertigo, I hope when they do, they will take Haunted by Vertigo with them. Edited by Sidney Gottlieb, and Charles Barr is one of the contributors. Thank you both very much. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Netflix's hit crime series Ozark returns to screens today for the last installment of the show. The series stars Jason Bateman and Laura Linney as Marta and Wendy Bird, a married couple who relocate their family to the Lakes of Ozarks and end up money laundering. The fourth and final season of Ozark is split into 2 7-episode parts. The second set will be available later in the year. The series has received a total of 32 Emmy Award nominations. I'm joined by Arlene Hunt, who has been watching season 4 for us. Arlene, before we go on to season 4, can you remind us of the premise of the series and how this mildly successful accountant and his public relations wife ended up laundering money for a Mexican cartel in the Ozarks in Missouri?
It started off back in Chicago. Marty Bird and his partner Bruce were financial advisors who were laundering money for a Mexican drug cartel. But unfortunately, Bruce, who was Marty's partner, had the bright idea to skim money off the top of the money that they were supposed to be laundering for the drug cartel. And obviously that didn't work out too well for him, and it resulted in absolute carnage. Marty, who was also due to be killed once they discovered that, you know, that they were involved in this skim off it, sort of pulled out of his pocket this brochure that he had. He'd been carrying this brochure about the Ozarks in his pocket, and immediately started waffling on to Dell, who was the hitman sent to clear up this mess in Chicago, talking about how, you know, if they went to the Ozarks, it was prime location for money laundering. And he basically swore an allegiance with the devil, if you will, to sort of, if you let him live, he would clean so much money for the drug cartel. They wouldn't even know how much money. So he basically was given the opportunity to go to the Ozarks, clean about $8 million in drug cartel money within 3 months, which seems like an outrageously impossible thing to do. But Marty, with his back against the wall and a gun against his forehead, decides to take
this on.
Yes,
because Marty is no criminal. It's not that, you know, he's just been dabbling in it and then got in too deep because he finds himself in the maw of a Mexican cartel.
God bless you. I love that. He's not a criminal, but he's just, you know, dabbling in a Mexican drug cartel.
Well, to where he gets. That's really what I was going to ask. Right. How does he?
He goes down into deeper wells, if you like, of crime, for sure. And, you know, he has a complex relationship with his wife, Wendy. Wendy, played by Laura Linney.
Yes, and that's a complex relationship from the beginning. Their life was, their marriage was a little rocky from the beginning.
Okay, yeah. So she was about to leave him, and she had cleared out their bank account of every single penny they had, which is about 21,000.
Pretty rocky, I guess, yeah.
Pretty rocky, yeah, 21,000. And because she was about to leave him and take their children, Jonah and Charlotte, with her, she was going to meet her lover on a Thursday. And the lover who she was going to leave Marty for is, as Marty's going to confront her, falls out of a window onto the ground from a very great height and is subsequently dead. And it turns out that the same Mexican cartel who Marty has now struck this deal with actually decide to kill her lover so that she stays with Marty, so that the ruse of the family must stay together. And that's what happens. And that's how they're sort of forced back into a united married front.
Right. So skip ahead a few seasons. They get involved in all kinds of criminality in the Ozarks to launder this money. And how do they find the locals? Are the locals accommodating, welcoming to the group, or have they got their own criminal game going?
Well, they're sort of low level ranking a criminal family called the Langmores, who are there already. In particular, one girl, a very young girl called Ruth Langmore. And Ruth Langmore, the Langmores themselves are not that smart. They're low level criminals. But Ruth is clever. She's clever. She's very intelligent. And it's actually her initial dalliance with the Bird family is when she actually robs the $8 million that Marty has been taxed to clean from their motel room. and takes off with it with her family. And Marty discovers who has taken this money. He goes off after them. He takes the money back. But it immediately sets the boundary. Like, they know that this guy is involved in more than he's letting on to be involved with. And they believe, the Langmoors as a clan, believe that they can, you know, sort of buy in with him and in the long term take over whatever action he has going on. And Marty's not a foolish man, but he at the same time knows how to handle the Langmoors. And so he gets his money back, but he immediately creates a miasma of animosity between the Langmoors, because the Langmoors are very rough and ready. On top of that, we've got the Snells there, that, and they have their own heroin industry in the Ozarks that they're protecting and that they're trying to have distribution about. And one of the in particular is the woman, Darlene Snell, who is... It's an interesting thing about this series is a lot of the women around Marty are so much worse than Marty could ever possibly be. And it's really interesting to watch him try to navigate the waters around the women in his life, because they are lethal.
Now, if we could skip ahead maybe to the end of, you know, series three, how did that end? So how do we find ourselves at the beginning of season four without too much complication?
OK, so people who have been following the show, the end of season three was absolutely jaw dropping. Genuinely, it was one of the best pieces of TV I've watched in a long time. Marty and his wife, Wendy. Wendy's a piece of work. I have to say, she really is. And in season three, she orchestrates the death of her own brother, because Wendy has political leanings that she wants to do. She wants to become somebody with a lot of power behind the scene, a lot of influence behind the scene, political influence. And her brother was a threat to that to her, because he was bipolar and he'd come off his medication. He'd got involved with Ruth. There was a lot of things going on in the background that she in particular could not allow happen. And Marty, during season three, Marty becomes slightly afraid of Wendy, which is really interesting. You know, they go to see a marriage counsellor, and it turns out that both of them are paying this marriage counsellor to say what they want him to say. So inevitably, it all becomes a little bit unravelled with Helen, who is an enforcer for the Navarro crime family. And so Helen tries to set them up. Marty tries to set Helen up. Marty also tries to set his wife up. Everyone tries to set each other up. And it ends and culminates in season three with Marty and Wendy being brought to the Mexican family home of Navarro, Omar Navarro. And they think they're going to die there. And Helen is there as well. And Helen thinks they're going to die there. And as it turns out, and I hope I'm not destroying spoilers for people who are just following along.
Yes, maybe they could stick their fingers in their ears now.
Just for the moment, if you don't want to hear what happens at the end of season three, I just turn your radio down for a second. But Helen, who thinks she has the upper hand of all of this, walks down to meet them at the car. And Helen, basically, they blow her brains out all over Marty and Wendy. They have bits of this woman's brain in their hair.
All right. Okay. That was Janet McAteer's role. Yes. Is that right? Yes.
Yes. It was fabulous.
Okay.
It was great.
Okay, well, after that rather gruesome interlude, you can turn up your radios again. And we're now in season four. Omar Navarro, one of the Navarro Mexican cartel, that's played by Felix Solis, tells Wendy, that's Laura Linney, and Marty, Jason Bateman, about his plan. He plans to walk away from the cartel, and he tells them how they're going to help him do it.
You will use your influence to allow me to walk away.
What does that mean, exactly?
I will walk away from my business. I will be free of the threat of arrest or assassination. And I will be able to move freely to the United States, back and forth, where you have established my children's business empire.
I'm sorry, that's impossible.
Please don't use that word, Wendy.
What other word could I use?
I think what Wendy means is that the FBI, they don't make any agreements that aren't advantageous to them.
Oh, I am aware that I will have to make some concessions.
Concessions?
Yes. Concessions. Isn't this exactly what you were doing, Wendy? With your foundation, the brand. Well, you can transform yourself into a pillar of society, but you won't do the same for me?
You know, to be fair, we're not globally recognized cartel leaders. on every most wanted list in the world.
Do this and you are free of your obligation to me.
You see, you just can't compare them. They're not globally recognized cartel leaders. So here we go. The kingpin wants to walk away. That can't be simple.
It's not simple. And it becomes even more complex. There's a lot going on, obviously, in season four, and I don't want to give too much away. But from the early outset, Omar has a huge problem on his hand with his nephew, Javi, who comes along. And Javi would be a lieutenant for the cartel. Javi's an educated man. He went to school in Chicago. He's, you know, business educated. But Javi is practically unhinged from the word go. He is everything that you don't want to have in a subordinate, because he's not a subordinate. He thinks he's smarter than everybody else in the room. And he especially thinks he's smarter than his uncle, who has been the de facto leader of the Navarro clan for so long that he feels he's untouchable. But Javi has aspirations, and he has long-standing aspirations that he plans to take over. And he doesn't necessarily like that Wendy and Marty have as much freedom as they have, because he doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand why his uncle is not more ruthless with them and has not got more control over them. And you can see how this guy is going to be an enormous thorn in everybody's side, because he's not somebody you can contain. He's not somebody you can control. Even his own uncle, who's a very powerful man and has been, obviously, you know, to have survived as long as he has in the business that he is in, to survive as long as he has to be ruthless and dangerous and everything else. And he's nothing compared to this younger guy coming up behind him. So we'll see now over season four how it's one thing for Wendy and Marty to strike a deal with Omar, because Omar has a businessman's ideology behind him. He can see things in the greater picture. I don't think Javi is going to see things in the same way as his uncle does.
Right. Well, obviously, we said that Wendy and Marty had children, and it'll be interesting to know that in a criminal world, you can also have some problems with your family. So let's finish on a clip.
How do you explain this to a teenager whose only job is to hate you in the first place?
Jonah doesn't hate anything. He doesn't. He's, you know, he needs a breath. And he's smart. He's going to see that we just need to push through to the other side, and then we'll be free of the cartel, and we're going to have all the political capital we need to change people's lives, Wendy.
I'm not fucking losing.
I believe you.
So how do we not lose?
The only way anyone ever not loses anything, we need large numbers of money, and then we need to buy all the people.
Oh my God, they haven't mended their ways. My thanks to Arlene Hunt. The first seven episodes of the fourth and final season of Ozark is available on Netflix now, and the final seven episodes will be available later in the year. Time now for album reviews. And first up, Miles Kane, one of the young breed of indie kids who emerged at the beginning of this century from England, a contemporary of Arctic Monkeys and founding member of The Rascals. His fourth solo album is called Change the Show, and it's out today. Next up, Silverbacks, a Dublin-based post-punk band who released their first album in July 2020. The band was founded by brothers Daniel and Killian O'Kelly as far back as 2008. And today they release album number two with the somewhat tongue-in-cheek title Archive Material. And finally, American singer-songwriter Janice Ian. She first came to widespread attention with her hit in 1967, Society's Child. She topped the charts in 1975 with her album Between the Lines, which featured the global hit at 17. And now, age 70, she brings us her latest album, The Light at the End of the Line. Louise Bruton and Pat Carty have been listening. And let's start with Miles Kane. Change the Show is the album, and this is Nothing's Ever Going to Be Good Enough, featuring Corinne Bailey-Ray.
Can you tell? Because it's all I've got.
Miles Kane there with the song Nothing's Ever Going to Be Good Enough, taken from his fourth solo album, Change the Show. And I'm bopping away here, Louise Bruton and Pat Carty, less so. Maybe you'll introduce us, Louise, to Miles Kane, first of all.
Okay, so like you said there, he was part of the big indie boom of around 2006-2007, which at the time all you really needed to enter was a guitar and a freshly bought t-shirt from Top Man. So during this time, he cozied up to Alex Turner, who's the frontman of the Arctic Monkeys, and the two of them would have toured together as the Rascals and the Arctic Monkeys. But the two of them had such a camaraderie that they formed a band called The Last Shadow Puppets. So this would have been a band at the time who kind of got in a bit of trouble for bad boy posturing, being slightly misogynistic in interviews, kind of hamming up the rock star profile, playing a character and not being able to kind of see the line of
both of them.
Both of them, they were kind of egging each other on in a while. Miles Kane particularly getting a lot of slack from one journalist from Fact magazine. But with his solo album, with this album, he continues to fit the mould of whatever Enemy seems to think a rock star is. And the best way to describe this album is if you've ever wanted to listen to 11 songs that sound a bit like an expensive version of the Only Fools and Horses sound theme song, this is where
I
you should go.
I was wondering why she wasn't bopping along. And what about Corinne Bailey-Ray there? She's a great voice.
She is. She was probably a casualty of that time as well, where she shot to extreme overnight fame and then just wasn't really able to follow that up. So it is great to see her name kind of back on the kind of live recording circuit.
But maybe not with him, the way you're talking.
She could be making better choices.
So he created this in conjunction with Sunglasses for Jaws. Tell us who they are, Pat.
Sunglasses for Jaws are a pair of people called Sunglasses for Jaws, and that's the extent of my knowledge about them. They had, he said that they're kind of a psychedelic kind of duo. And he said that this inspired him. And it was the first time, God help him, he said he felt old because they had this energy. So and this is in the press release now, and the press release tells us this is the album we've been waiting for. I'm not sure that's the case. But
Were you waiting for it? Or are you not sure?
Okay. No, I'm sure. I'm sure I wasn't waiting for it. And, you know, he said he brought this energy to this. And, you know, I think, you know, The Last Shadow Puppets, I like that first album. I think it's all right. But everything else he's done has been very workman, you know, there's a difference. The difference between competent and inspired just isn't there. You know, if you had the influences he brings to bear on this record, someone like Paul Weller can come along and make a great record. That's maybe in a similar area, but he just has that extra X factor. This guy, you know, I happen to have met Miles Kane once, and he seemed like a perfectly nice fella and good luck to him. But It's just competent. It's just, there's nothing. I'd have no interest in going out of here after and putting it on in the car again. You know, it'd be that kind of a record.
And I know you don't agree with his attitudes, past or probably present, Louise, but what about his music?
Well, kind of a little bit what Pat is saying is there's not much of a point to any of the songs. Mm. There's no real story. Nothing really happens. The band sounds great. Like, it's an expensively made record and you can give full credit to everyone who kind of put in their craftsmanship there. But in terms of just following a storyline, there isn't much there. And when I was listening to this album, I kept thinking about Harry Styles and how Harry Styles has actually done something quite similar in this, in that he's created a throwback record for people who are just discovering 70s music for the first time. Whereas Harry Styles has charm and he can pull these things off. He can take the simplistic kind of melodies and lyrics and he can inject a huge amount of personality into them. But Miles Kane is just pretending to be somebody else, and that's the unfortunate thing.
Okay, well, let's pick another track which has that kind of maybe simplistic title, at least, that you've been talking about. And I think you like this one, Pat. Adios, Tra, Tara, Tara. Adios, Tara, Tara, from Change the Show by Miles Kane.
Does that save the day?
Not really. I mean, I think when you said I liked it there, that was probably giving it a bit too much credit. I thought it was maybe better than the rest of the stuff. His influences are there again. You know, he sounds a bit like late period Mark Bolan in The Voice. There's a bit
That's
of traffic.
That's a good thing.
It is a good thing. Yeah, it is a good thing. But, you know, why not sound like yourself? But there's a bit of maybe traffic going on with some of the horns in the background. You know, it's all fine. It's competent enough. And Louise made a great point. If you hadn't heard those, the records I'm talking about there and the records he's obviously yes. influenced by, you'd probably think, hey, yeah, this is good. But
So, I suppose.
I'd give it 2, and I'm probably being generous there.
And for you, Louise?
A slightly kinder 2.5.
2.5, 2.5, and 2. That's for Miles Kane. Now, next up, Dublin-based post-rock band Silverbacks and their second album is Archive Material, billed as a lockdown album. Pat, who are they?
Silverbacks are a 5-piece from Dublin, centred around the brothers Daniel and Killian O'Kelly, who got together. Well, they got together because they were living in the same house, I suppose. But they were talking about sending files back and forward when one of them was studying music in Maynooth, and then they both joined up there. And that's where they met Emma Hanlon, who plays the bass and sings, and also guitarist Patter Carney. And then later on, it all came together. They changed their name from Mighty Good Leaders when they got drummer Gary Wickham on board. Now, they had a couple of singles in Just a Better View in 2017, Dunkirk a year later. They went on tour with Gillaband and roped in Daniel Fox, the bassist of Gillaband, to produce the debut album Fad, which got great notices. Then, as you say, this is the lockdown one. This is the one that we're working on since.
Okay. And Louise, you might introduce Archive Material, the title track.
Okay. So the way that they're looking at this, and the greatest thing about Silverbacks is their personality that they've really injected into it. It's very droll humour. So what they've said about this album is it's given a real insight to life in lockdown, and says that anyone seeking to make sense of what life was like during a global pandemic, they should extend their research beyond the newspaper clippings and dive into the art produced during that time. And what they've very nicely done is they haven't kind of revisited the themes that we're all sick to death of, which is isolation and loss and will this ever end? But there's a bit more going on about, say there's one song where Daniel, it's called A Job Worth Something, and the band member Daniel, he works in insurance, whereas he was seeing his sister go off every day working as a frontline worker in a COVID ward. And that song has that kind of inferiority complex that some people were feeling. And they ask, waking up with no purpose, just to go to sleep. Who had a job worth something when we're just hanging on?
So I guess Archive Material is challenging what we might think of Archive.
What we'll remember and what we'll misremember. Yeah.
Great voice. Archive Material there from Silverbacks. So, Pat, I was reading that they were very influenced by their father's CD collection. And their father kind of, you know, gave them a CD per night to study and to take on board. And do you see that in the tracks on this album?
Yeah, it's a good policy from their dad, first of all. I might try that with my own children. The one that they mention, and I think you can really tell it's there, is Television's Marquee Moon. And the influence of that, I think, is... Well, also, there's a Pavement as well, which I wouldn't be as crazy about myself. But Television's Marquee Moon, I think on the guitars on this album. And there was a song, Pink Tide on Fad as well, that's very prevalent on. But the songs on this album, not only just the way they have the arrangements, but the sound of the guitar itself, you know, there's not an overuse of effects. And it's very inventive guitar playing. I haven't seen them live, you know, obviously with what's going on, but I did see them do one of those Jameson Connect sessions, and they were really, really great. I mean, obviously we don't have to sit through that anymore. We can go and see them now, which is great news. It's complex, it's original. When I heard the album first, it just my own taste, some of the left turns left me looking at the floor, but the more I've listened to it, I've changed my mind about it completely.
And that's Daniel on vocals there, is that right?
Yeah, but on some other tracks as well, Emma, she contributes her vocals for lead vocals, and it gives it kind of a softer approach to garage rock, particularly the song I'm Wild, which I believe is the closing track of the album. And there is just, it's such an enjoyment factor here where they have this ability to be kind of rough or gentle, sincere and sarcastic, funny or very straight. And there is a huge amount of variety there. And what I really like about Silverbacks is there's absolutely no ego. So when they're singing, we're definitely singing from the same hymn sheet as well.
Well, let's hear Emma Hanlon, who takes the vocals in this, I'm Wild. Emma Hanlon there, the lead vocalist from Archive Material on that track, I'm Wild, from the Silverbacks. I think you're both very positive about this. How does it translate into stars from you, Louise?
Definite 4 stars for me.
4 stars. And for you, Pat?
Yeah, it was going to be 3, but the more I hear it, it's gone up. So let's add another one and give it 4 as well, yep.
Okay. And finally, singer-songwriter Janice Ian released her first album in 15 years. That's The Light at the End of the Line. And she says it will be her last. That's a fairly definitive thing to say. She's only 70. Louise?
Yeah, well, there is something quite powerful, I think, in someone finally saying, no, this is the last for me, you'll hear no more. But Janice Ian has been busy. So this is her 23rd album. And she has been working since she's been about 13 or 14 years old. She faced some career challenges thanks to Bill Cosby, who definitely tried to blacklist her when she was a teenager. And that, I think, has put a bit of fight into Janice Ian, probably when she didn't need to when she was so young. And that has come out in the shape of a song called Resist, which is sort of a very kind of like sassy and kind of humorous Me Too anthem for someone who's basically been saying Me Too since they were a child.
Okay, let's listen. Too hot, too wet, too sticky. Oh, what an ugly girl. Oh, what an ugly girl. Put her in high heels so she can't run. Carve out between her legs so she can't come. Get her a dress for easy access. Yeah, that's a pretty strong anthem, all right, from Janice Ian, from The Light at the End of the Line, that's Resist. So Pat's still angry, but has she still got it musically, do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought so, no. I tell you, the problem with this, I mean, as you heard the song there, there's some very admirable lyrical concerns on this album, no doubt about it. And, you know, she addresses ageing and she addresses, there's a song about refugees, there's that song you heard there. But the arrangements and the songwriting let this down. First of all, on the arrangement side of thing, you know, if it's a song with just an acoustic guitar, it's just very plain. There's a couple of songs with just piano, very simple piano. There's not an awful lot going on. I mean,
not okay?
Well, I mean, it could be okay in if the songs were stronger, you know? I mean, there's songs there that you know, she starts off and you're crying out for a mid late or something like that, some sort of change of pace. And then when she does bring in stuff like the last song, Better Things Are Coming or something like that, I can't even remember, Better Things Are Coming, you know, it's just, she throws the kitchen sink at it and it's a mistake.
Okay, Louise? You know?
But I think some of the softer songs probably deserve a little bit of credit, because while I do think she errs on the side of cheesy a lot of the time, there are 2 songs that I think stand out, and one is Nina, which is dedicated to Nina Simone. So Nina Simone covered one of Janice's songs, Stars, in 1976, and the two of them did have a complicated friendship. And this is an ode to their tricky relationship. And I think that as part of an album which seems like Janice's musical memoir, where she's kind of looking back at those moments where she didn't stand up for herself or the moments where she did, this is a song where she makes her peace with her friend who was also kind of chastised.
So if I could ask you for stars, because we want to honour somebody else before we leave. Pat, for Janice Ian, The Light at the End of the Line.
It gives me no pleasure to say so, but I didn't like this at all. I'd only give it 1.
Genesian on her 70th year. Yeah, and from you, Louise.
Three stars. To finish off her career.
You're making me look bad now.
Pat Carty and Louise Booten, thank you very much. But let's end remembering the artist who left us today, Meatloaf. Here he is with Cher and their hit, Dead Ringer for Love. Cher and the dear departed Meatloaf, we won't see his like again. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Leah Murphy and Paula Shields. Pather Carney was on sound. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Ola McGowan.